I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio now have three new challengers to get the Republican nomination for president. Earlier this week, Surgeon Ben Carson announced his run in Detroit using a gospel choir and saying he'd be a different kind of candidate.
And I got to tell you something. I'm not politically correct. And I'm probably never... I'm probably never going to be politically correct because I'm not a politician. I don't want to be a politician because politicians do what is politically expedient. And I want to do what's right.
Carly Fiorina, former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, who also announced this week, has made it clear in the last few months that her focus will be on Hillary Clinton. Here's some of what she said at a forum in Iowa earlier this year.
Like Hillary Clinton, I too have traveled hundreds of thousands of miles around the globe. But unlike her, I've actually accomplished something. You see, Mrs. Clinton... flying is not an accomplishment, it is an activity. I have met Vladimir Putin, and I know that it takes far more than a gimmicky red reset button to halt his ambition.
Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee also said he was giving a bid for the White House his second try after losing in 2008. Here's a clip from his announcement this week.
We will deal with jihadis just as we would deal with deadly snakes. And let there be no doubt, Israel will know, as will the whole world, that we are their trusted friend, and the Ayatollahs of Iran will know that hell will freeze over before they get a nuclear weapon.
Well, joining us in this edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times is Robert Casa, a national political reporter for The Washington Post. Robert, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Also with us is Sam Stein. He's political editor, White House correspondent for the Huffington Post. And Sam, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure being here.
Well, it's nice to have the two of you here and listening to that Mike Huckabee. I don't think I've ever heard a sentence with the word snakes, Israel, and Iran all in one sentence. Let me begin with you, Robert, if I could. There are now six candidates running for the Republican nomination for president. How many more waiting in the wings based on your calculations?
It's an expansive, colorful field, different than 2012 in both number and the type of people running. I think we're going to probably see a dozen candidates, perhaps more, by year's end. And this is going to put the Republican Party in a difficult position, especially once these primary debates start. How many people can you actually fit on stage?
Well, and that reminds me, Sam, of the last go-round when the stage was filled with Republicans who wanted to be president of the United States.
Yeah, so it'll have to be a long stage, I guess. it's funny, you see these early poll numbers in there. It's sort of reflective of how crowded the field is. None of these candidates are really breaking out of the teens, and if anyone pops above 20, they're deemed the front runner. So I'm very curious to see how this all shakes out. There's a myriad of different probabilities and possibilities in terms of who gets what type of vote and what states work for which type of candidate. And it's incredibly up in there, which makes it exciting for me and Bob, I guess.
Well, Bob, let me go back to you, and let's start with Mike Huckabee, who we heard he made his announcement earlier this week. He ran in 2008. Is this a different Mike Huckabee from what you can glean, Robert Costa?
It was fascinating to watch Governor Huckabee's announcement speech in his hometown of Hope, same hometown as former President Clinton, because Huckabee has not changed his political persona much since he first started to enter the political scene in 2007 ahead of the 2008 primaries. This is someone who's an evangelical favorite, a Baptist preacher, someone who comes out of that world in the deep South of faith and family, and that's really his pitch. And he started out his career as someone who was an assistant to a televangelist, then he became a talk and radio show host himself. But since he won the Iowa caucuses in 2008 and kind of surged ahead, at least for a brief moment, he has remained this folksy character in the Republican Party. But he is interesting in the one respect that he's talking about populism, and he's talking about income inequality, and he has a blue-collar message, and that's different than a lot of the other contenders.
Is that how you see him, Sam?
A little bit different. You know, we sent our reporter down there, Scott Conroy, to the announcement, and what he came back with is the same impression I have, which is this is a guy who's appealing, to put it bluntly, to old voters. I mean, he is making a very generational appeal. It was struck by the fact that he went out there and he defended, which you don't see Republicans do all that often, defended the sanctity of Social Security and Medicare, saying these benefits are earned and you shouldn't take them away. I thought it was an interesting contrast with Chris Christie, who's positioning himself as a truth teller on entitlements. But Huckabee, even down to the entertainer who introduced his announcement speech, very much a overt play to older generational voters. Not totally different than what Bob was just saying, but I was just struck by how limited in some respects his pitch was.
Well, Bob, let me quote another thing that Mike Huckabee said, and this is about foreign affairs, but he says, when I hear the current president, of course that's Barack Obama, say he wants Christians to get off their high horse so we can make nice with radical jihadists, I wonder if he could watch a Western from the 1950s and be able to figure out who the good guy and who the bad guys are. I mean, I guess you have to be pretty old to be able to remember watching Westerns in the 1950s, something that I can remember. But, this is colorful language, but I don't know how do you, and it touches, it says Christians and jihadists. Is there a policy there?
I mean, Sam touched on the generational argument. That singer that was at the Huckabee announcement was Tony Orlando. And I think Huckabee is appealing to older voters and their vision of America and their general hawkishness when it comes to foreign policy. Huckabee is not a foreign policy expert of any sort. He's a longtime governor of a small state. But he believes that the party is moving in that hawkish direction, and it's about sounding tough. It's about sounding aggressive on issues like Israel and being staunch defenders of that country and its allies and its mission. But this is no different than most of the rest of the Republican field. Even Rand Paul, who was supposed to give us a more intriguing debate in 2016, he's sounding more hawkish these days.
Oh, interesting. You said yes, Sam?
Yeah, well, it's also interesting. I agree with that 100%. But what I find interesting is how much of the early talk has been focused on foreign policy. And that might be just, it could either be a reflection of the times we're in. The economy is doing a little bit better. There's a lot more problems for President Obama on the international stage. It could be a response to the fact that Hillary Clinton will likely be the Democratic nominee in her most recent job. Was Secretary of State. But I'm assuming if we had this conversation 6 months ago, for instance, the vast majority of the Republican rhetoric would have been focused on the economy, on domestic issues, on stuff like immigration, for instance, and the border crisis and Ebola and all those things. And I've been struck, even in the clips that you played to introduce this show, how much of that was simply about foreign policy.
Well, let me pick up on Carly Fiorina, and she was CEO at Hewlett-Packard. She got actually fired by the board in 2005. What's interesting about her, Robert, and we didn't play her announcement this week, but we went to the more sort of snarky and aggressive comments that she has said about Hillary Clinton. And it seems like she feels like maybe because she's a woman that she can take on Hillary in a pretty personal way. Robert?
No, that's exactly right. I thought you were playing a clip.
No, sorry. No, go ahead.
No, I mean, I've been following Carly Fiorina on the campaign trail for the last few weeks here and there. And in any other election year, she'd be a fringe candidate, an outside contender for the Republican nomination. This is someone who lost a Senate race in California in 2010, was fired unceremoniously from her job as an executive at Hewlett-Packard. And so how does she get oxygen? Well, because the reason she's getting attention is, as you said, the Republican field is pretty bare when it comes to female candidates. So she's able to play that role as kind of a woman who's able to take on Clinton and not worry so much about the gender concerns. But also, there's no clear front runner on the Republican side. Jeb Bush has struggled to really get that status. And because of that, because there's no Romney-type figure, a McCain coming back for a second run, figures like Carly Fiorina think they have a shot.
Well, and let me quote my colleague here at the WHYY at Newsworks, Dick Pullman, at a piece about Carly Fiorina. Give this to you, Sam. I'll just quote from Dick. He says, if you're not familiar with her record, here it is. She was fired in 2005 after making deals that wreaked havoc in the firm. This would be HP. During her six-year tenure, HP stock lost half of its value. The board of directors kicked her out, gave her a golden parachute worth more than $20 million. Stockholders were so furious they sued, albeit in vain. CNBC lists her as one of the worst American CEOs of all time. I mean, it doesn't seem like that's a resume that you can run on, Sam.
It's not the most promising resumes of all time. There might have been worse. I don't know. It does complicate what she's trying to do, and it certainly complicated her initial foray into politics when she ran for the Senate in California in the 2010 election. Whether we get to the point where this is brought up in a serious fashion depends a lot on how she does in these primaries. But let's say, theoretically, that she becomes a serious mid-level front-running type candidate. I presume that this is all in the opposition research documents that her opponents will have. But she has issues beyond just her own business background. I mean, she's an incredibly talented communicator. Mm-hmm. She gets the crowd going better than a lot of these people in the field. Bob can attest to, like, her speech at CPAC was incredible. But she is ideologically really out of sync with the Republican Party as it currently stands. She has spoken out, for instance, in favor of cap and trade. Her positions on immigration, for instance, have been problematic. She was supportive of the TARP bailout, things that will make her, persona non grata among the Tea Party crowd. So once we unravel a little bit of Carly Fiorina, I think she faces a lot of problems. But she's serving a purpose right now, which is she's the upfront, foremost attack dog on Hillary Clinton, and she does it incredibly well.
Let's talk a bit. We're almost up on a break here, Robert, but let's just begin talking a bit about Ben Carson, a very famous surgeon, has been talking politics for some time now. He decided this week that he's going to run for president. How do you see his candidacy, Robert?
He is the stereotypical outsider candidate. He is speaking to those conservatives in the Republican Party who feel disaffected by the Bush era, who have not really connected with the Republican Congress, and they want a new voice. They see him as someone who took on the president at a breakfast, a gathering with the president years ago, and they think he could be that voice this time around.
But can you say, I'm not a politician, and then run for office?
Well, that's so right, Marty. I mean, Sam and I have been following Dr. Carson here and there on the trail, and what you see from Dr. Carson is someone who's not a politician, and that's to his betterment in the polls sometimes. But when it comes to really dealing with the press, dealing with crowds, the media, he's not really up to speed. We have to see if he can get his sea legs.
Yeah, but I think what you're saying is, like, can someone running for the office of president of the United States successfully pull off the idea that they're not a politician?
Exactly.
It's just inherently contradictory. And I think, you know, no, you can't. I mean, by definition, you're a politician if you want to be president of the United States. Ben Carson's allure is that he will say things that aren't filtered, and that gets him an incredibly devoted following. People who were supportive of him at that CPAC conference that I just referenced had more of an emotional attachment to him than to any other candidate whose supporters I talked to. The problem is when he goes over the line a little bit and makes himself the news story. That's where he runs into trouble.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times, getting a glimpse into the 2016 presidential race. Sorry, folks. Our guests are Sam Stein of Huffington Post and Robert Costa of The Washington Post. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And as of this week, Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, Mike Huckabee join Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio, all vying for the Republican presidential nomination. And as of last week, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders announced his candidacy, the first to challenge Hillary Rodham Clinton, talking with Robert Costa and Sam Stein. You can join our conversation. Go to Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sam, I just want to pick up on something on Ben Carson in terms of some things that he's willing to say, including that Obamacare, the worst thing that has happened in this nation since slavery, comparing the United States to Nazi Germany. And recently he said the president, President Obama, resembled, quote, most psychopaths. Now, I can understand if people are critical of the president, not wanting him to go down in history as a great president, whether he is or not. But calling names like that and calling a president like most psychopaths, how is that going to play, even among the most sort of ardent conservatives among the GOP?
It plays to the most conservative, Obama-hating elements of the Republican Party. But beyond that, it prevents the doctor, who's an incredibly smart and serious person, a groundbreaking neurosurgeon. It prevents him from being taken seriously as a political figure. And that's just the long and the short of it. It makes him seem like a caricature of right-wing conservative talk radio. And if he wants to expand his political allure beyond that, inevitably, he'll have to distance himself from that type of rhetoric. And it's just unclear at this juncture if he's capable of doing that.
Robert, do you think any of these three candidates have a chance? I realize that's probably an unfair question. We're so early in this process. But as you look at the three of them, anything stand out?
Because it's such a crowded field, it's hard to rule anyone out at this point. At this point in the cycle in 2012, Rick Santorum was nowhere in the polls, just as Rick Santorum remains nowhere in the polls today. But he was able to win 11 states and caucuses.
That's right.
And that was because Romney was hobbled. And if Scott Walker, for some reason, starts to fade, and Marco Rubio never picks up as much speed as his people hope, and Jeb Bush, because of Bush fatigue and other reasons, doesn't excite the base, you're going to have a vacuum in the Republican Party, and any one of these contenders could enter it. The question is, can they raise the money with their super PACs to really go the distance? Because to win the Republican nomination in this day and age, you have to have more than buzz. You have to have a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of money. And Sam Stein, so much of politics now, especially national politics, is about a lot of money because of some Supreme Court decisions.
Yeah, and not just – it's even simpler than just a lot of money. You need one very rich donor, and that's about it, you know? If someone's willing to sort of front all that cash to your super PAC and keep you afloat, then you can pull off what Rick Santorum did and come tantalizingly close to winning the Republican nomination. So Robert's right. That's why you don't rule out at this juncture someone like Chris Christie, who in a poll in New Hampshire last night came in at a paltry 3% behind Donald Trump. But for his to his benefit, Chris Christie has great connections with a lot of very wealthy donors, and one of them can keep him afloat through these terrible months of bad polling. And if he were to make a comeback, that would be why.
Well, and Chris Christie, as I read this morning, is in New Hampshire today and tomorrow. How do you see his candidacy, Robert? And, of course, earlier this week, David Wildstein pled guilty to this just completely cockamamie scheme, apparently, you know, closing traffic lanes near the George Washington Bridge to punish the mayor of Fort Lee for not supporting Christie in his last go-round. He pled guilty. Two former associates of the governor have pled not guilty. They have been indicted. How much do you think this hurts Christie, even though apparently, you know, he's not among those who's gotten indicted?
He's not indicted, but the course of events is devastating politically for Governor Christie. When I was following him up in New Hampshire last month, I watched him at a couple town hall meetings, and one was in a bar, another was at an American Legion type place. And you just the impression you had, voters and reporters, was this is a raw political talent. This is someone who, if he didn't have these clouds from the Bridgegate over him, he'd be a top tier contender because of his middle class personality, his blue collar appeal, his ability to articulate issues in an upbeat way in this age where you need to have a little bit of personality to go along with it. But so many Republican donors I speak with, top party officials, they're really counting Christie out. But Sam said because of the force of money and Christie's ability to raise it and because of his ability and the way the field's playing out, he could find an opening, especially on a debate stage. He reminds me of a lot of Newt Gingrich from 2012. Gingrich was able to use the debates to fuel his candidacy even though he had little money and little buzz.
Sam, Christie has lost a lot of his luster in New Jersey among the people who either voted or for him or against him for governor. How does that play, do you think, on a national stage, or does it?
I think it does. You know, listen, the presumption of innocence is there. He has not been found, you know, to have any direct connection to this insane scheme to close down bridge lanes as retribution for lack of mayoral endorsement, as crazy as that seems. He's not connected to it. But even then, you know, the fallback option here is not that great either. What essentially he's saying is that the top people in my administration were allowed to run loose and concoct these insane efforts at political retribution. Therefore, you should trust me to run the country. Mm. It just doesn't fly. I mean, he's either a bad manager or he's corrupt. So getting beyond this Bridgegate scandal is going to prove incredibly complex and difficult for him. But even when he gets beyond that, you know, there are a lot of Republicans. The distrust didn't start because of Bridgegate. Distrust started because he welcomed Barack Obama open-armed into New Jersey during the closing days of the 2012 election to deal with hurricane recovery. And they thought that was a stabbing of Mitt Romney in the back at a critical moment of that election. And they just haven't forgiven him for it.
Let me ask about Jeb Bush. And Robert, you had a piece about Jeb Bush, Mike Murphy, I guess, running. Does he have a campaign yet? I mean, it's sort of like Hillary Clinton, sort of one foot in, one foot out. Where does he stand?
He's still not formally in the race, and it's because of this super PAC issue. If he announced his candidacy tomorrow, he would have to have a different kind of relationship with the super PAC. At least that's his campaign's interpretation of the election law. And so he's foregoing announcing for at least the short term. He's likely going to announce sometime in June or July. But in the meantime, he's in this weird static moment where he has to convince donors that he's picking up support in the early states and that he is going to be like his brother was in 1999, eventually the presumptive front runner. And in this moment, his aides are trying to reassure people, especially at a Miami donor retreat last month, that everything's going along as planned and that he's going to have more money than anyone else in the Republican field. And eventually their hope is he rises late as others flicker out.
How about for you, Sam? I mean, I don't know, how does the Bush name play among Republicans?
Yeah.
And he has been out of politics, such as it is, for a number of years now.
Yeah, I even that rust that you're alluding to, I haven't noticed it as much. Maybe Robert, who's on the trail a lot more than I am, he seems really natural in these, you know, question and answer sessions and these give and takes with voters. I don't think he's particularly lost his touch. And of course, he'll have more money than God, essentially, when he runs for president. So he has that, too, which brings us to the third element that you alluded to, which is the family name and, of course, his record in Florida. And from what I can detect and from the conversations I've had, people in the Republican Party do harbor some serious regrets with how the Bush years went. Keep in mind, a lot of the Tea Party movement that has personified conservative politics in the Obama era is rooted in George W. Bush's TARP, in George W. Bush's auto bailout, in George W. Bush's Medicare Part D, in George W. Bush's deficit spending, not to mention quibbles with the foreign policy. So until, you know, Jeb's going to have a difficult time with respect to his family name, and I think we're seeing indications of that in these early polls where he is sort of middle of the pack despite being supposedly being the big whale in the field.
I mean, he is the, what, establishment almost candidate, Robert Costa?
I mean, Scott Walker's trying to have that mantle as well. I think Sam hit on something that's really interesting that I've noticed as well, is that Bush, when he started out in this exploration phase, he was giving set speeches and he seemed a little stale and just uncomfortable on stage. But he's now moved on to these Q&A sessions where he's much more at ease. He's been very good on the stump recently, but as much as Bush is a talent and he is performing well and he is raising a ton of money, every time I see him, it's the kind of questions he's getting from activists and voters that are stunning to hear. Ted Cruz gets friendly questions. Mike Huckabee gets friendly questions. Then you'll get these cold questions for Bush about the Bush name, about dynasties, and Bush handles it well.
What does
it's
he
not
say?
That he's making missteps. He says, I'm going to have to show you my heart. I'm going to have to prove to you that I'm not taking anything for granted. I mean, he has all the right answers from a political point of view, but he hasn't clicked yet, and he's having a tough reception. That could change, though, because he's not acting like it's his and it's the crown is immediately going to be put on his head.
And it's not just dynasties. It's not just questions of family name and dynasty. Robert's right, like 100%. They're adversarial questions on policy, Common Core. Why would you support Common Core? Immigration reform. What is the deal? Why would you support immigration reform? You know, these are very combative interviews with what are, you know, for better or worse, conservative, often friendly interviewers. And you don't see that being asked of any of the other candidates in this race, with the exception of Chris Christie. Bush is there is still that sort of distrust between him and the commentariat on the right, and I'm wondering if that goes away.
Well, and I do want to just quickly reintroduce you, also give out email and phone numbers to our callers. And then I do want to play a clip of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders making his announcement, because we do need to talk about the other dynasty, which, of course, is the Clinton family. Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post, is our guest, along with Sam Stein, political editor, White House correspondent for The Huffington Post. You can send us an email. We are talking 2016 presidential politics. Email radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Well, let me set up the announcement that Bernie Sanders made earlier this month. In fact, it was last week. He announced last week that he was seeking the Democratic presidential nomination, a kind of a David versus Goliath mission, taking on Hillary Clinton and her well-funded, well-connected political campaign. Here's a short clip from his press conference.
The major issue is, how do we create an economy that works for all of our people rather than a small number of billionaires? And the second issue, directly related, is the fact that as a result of the disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, we now have a political situation where billionaires are literally able to buy elections and candidates. Let's not kid ourselves. That is the reality right now.
So, Sam, what do you make of Bernie Sanders challenging Hillary Clinton?
I mean, it seems sort of like the perfect setup for someone like him. And let's be totally, brutally honest about it. He's probably not going to win. Almost assuredly not going to win. I don't even think he thinks he's going to win. But he really genuinely does want to move the debate towards his side of not just the Democratic Party, but the political system more broadly. And so that means shining spotlight on issues like money and politics, for instance, or making the case that it's okay to want a European-style socialism here in the United States. You know, not everyone's going to agree with that. I think a lot of the country won't. But he does have resonance with a big swath of the country. For instance, we reported yesterday that in the 4 days since he made his announcement, he's raised $3 million, which isn't Trump change. It's not, a super
not Clinton money.
Will eclipse that. It's not Clinton money, but it's not Trump change. But something like 94% of all those donations were under $250. So that suggests that there is some grassroots momentum for what he's talking about. Is it going to be enough to propel him to a relevancy like Howard Dean or Barack Obama? Almost assuredly not. But I wouldn't just discount his role in this election.
Robert, do you think he represents the Elizabeth Warren, wing or faction of the Democratic Party?
Certainly. And he's not a cult of personality candidate, which is refreshing, and Sam hit it well, and that he really wants to be someone who's bringing the policy debate in a certain direction. This is someone who's in his 70s. He's had a long and distinguished career as an independent, self-described socialist in the U.S. House and then now in the U.S. Senate. And it's not because he loves the attention. In fact, he usually doesn't seem to like the attention at all when he's on the campaign trail.
Exactly.
He really wants to talk about banks. He wants to talk about the way money has such a grip on American politics and on Congress. And he wants to force Clinton to have that debate, even if she doesn't want to have it day in, day out. And because Warren is reluctant to run, and Warren's playing an important role in shaping the debate from the outside, but Sanders wants to be in the arena. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to his top advisor yesterday, Tad Devine, and Devine said, look, Sanders has run grassroots campaigns his entire career. He's good at it. Don't underestimate him in terms of someone who could actually get some popularity in Iowa and other places where organizing matters.
In fact, Sam, you wrote that Bernie Sanders is getting some help from some former aides to President Barack Obama.
Yeah, a firm of comprised of former Obama aides are going to be running digital operations for Bernie Sanders, helping with social media ads and online fundraising. You know, it's just evidence that he's not the caricature that many people think of him, which is someone who is incredibly outside the mainstream, not part of either party, and therefore is this odd duckling in American politics. In fact, there are elements of the mainstream Democratic Party that genuinely want to see him succeed, and those include people who worked for President Barack Obama. What that gets him, I don't know.
Well, but you think, I mean, just strategically, Robert, that he wants to get into the debates? I mean, it looks like, and we'll talk about Hillary Clinton, it looks like she is expressing a more sort of liberal side of herself. But do you think he literally just wants to get in the debate so that he can put these issues out here?
It's clear he does. And this was actually a strategic decision Senator Sanders had to make, because as an independent, he could have ran as an independent. And someone who runs as an independent doesn't get the chance to be on a Democratic primary debate stage. And he deliberately chose to move away from his independent association and enter the Democratic primary because he wants to be have the attention for his issues on the stage. And the thing that's interesting about Martin O'Malley, the former Maryland governor, about Bernie Sanders now in the race, about Jim Webb, the former Virginia senator who's in a race, all these people who are thinking about being Clinton rivals on the Democratic side, they don't detest Clinton personally. They don't really attack her in a negative way. They don't talk about the foundation or her lost emails. They really want to shift the policy debate in the Democratic Party, and that's partially to Clinton's benefit that it's not going to be a nasty process, even if Bernie's pretty vocal.
We're almost having a break here. Sam, an email from Eddie says, I would like to ask your guest why Hillary Clinton should be part of a dynasty. Is it because she's married to Bill Clinton? Does that take away from her independent accomplishments and qualifications? Can you respond to that, Sam?
I guess technically a dynasty is from one generation to another, not from one a husband to a wife. But, of course, the Clinton name is what we're talking about. And, you know, I think in some respects she's going to have very similar challenges that Jeb Bush has with George W. Bush. And we're already seeing it. For instance, Bill Clinton's crime bill, the 94 crime bill, incredibly tough on crime, setting the stage in some respects for the mass incarcerations that have become problematic in cities and states across the country. She's had to tiptoe away from that. The deregulation that took place at the end of the 90s, something that presaged a lot of the financial crisis at the end of the George W. Bush administration, she has to walk away from that. A welfare reform, a NAFTA, these are policies that in the context of the 90s seem sort of down the middle, a little bit maybe left-to-center policies. Today, the parties move very much further to the left, and they pose problems for her in some of the respects that George W. Bush's policies pose problematic for Jeb.
And that's Sam Stein, political editor and White House correspondent for The Huffington Post. Also with us, Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Join our conversation and call us at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In fact, it's Ballot Talks on Radio Times. A wrap-up of 2016 presidential politics so far. We have six Republicans running for president. Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, and Mike Huckabee announced that they were running this week. Previously, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio all said they wanted to be president of the United States, the Republican president. And now Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is challenging Hillary Clinton to be the Democratic presidential candidate. And again, Sam Stein and Robert Costa are guests. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Before we get back to our callers, I just wanted to ask actually you, Robert, about both of you, about this Clinton Cash book. It's by a guy named Peter Schweitzer. I've heard a couple of interviews with him. And where he talks about the donations to the Clinton Foundation. He hasn't, to my ears anyway, proved the kind of quid pro quo that people gave money to the foundation or even to Bill Clinton in order to get foreign policy decisions from Hillary Clinton. But nonetheless, how much do you think this is hurting her campaign? Robert?
When you look at the latest poll numbers, whether it's New York Times, CBS, or other polls from The Washington Post, you don't see any kind of significant drop due to the foundation stories for Secretary Clinton. There's a little hurt here and there, but it hasn't become some kind of sweeping change on her candidacy. And that's because Schweitzer, though he's gotten a lot of headlines, as you say, there's no smoking gun, there's no quid pro quo. But it does raise questions that are going to animate the political debate for the rest of the year. Republicans believe there's a vulnerability there with Clinton and her foundation and tying her to foreign governments. And they think it weakens her chief argument, perhaps, that she has foreign policy experience and that she was an effective Secretary of State.
Because, Sam, what we see are foreign governments giving a lot of money to the Clinton Foundation. We see Bill with speaking fees as high as $500,000. He became very rich as a post-president. How do you see this playing?
Well, I mean, obviously there are serious questions about transparency and accountability. The fact that some of these records are now just now being turned up of donations when they clearly were supposed to have been turned up during her tenure as Secretary of State. And this, of course, ties into the whole email issue and just this dark cloud of secrecy. But I do also recognize that no smoking gun has been found. And the other thing that you have to consider is when these attacks, these sort of plutocrat attacks were made against Mitt Romney, the reason that they proved effective was because they reinforced a narrative about who he was as a businessman and perhaps as a politician. And so people started getting into their heads, this is someone who, you know, cozied up to the wealthy and was therefore going to give them tax breaks and so on and so forth. I'm not sure that the idea that Bill Clinton is giving large speaking fees fulfill the narrative that he's a man of plutocrats. I think that him and his wife's policies tend to be far more progressively oriented when it comes to issues like taxation, for instance. So I'm not sure they fulfill the attack, but they certainly put her off message. They put her campaign on the defensive. And I think that will, if this lingers much longer, I think that will have an impact.
Robert, I noticed that Hillary Clinton has agreed to testify about Benghazi. Is this an effort, you think, to try to get this off the table so that she can move ahead with her campaign?
She's trying to move ahead, but this is a Republican Congress that is refusing to let the Benghazi issue go away. Trey Gowdy, the congressman from South Carolina who's leading the investigation in the House, he believes he can present a non-political front for the GOP as they pursue this. He's a prosecutor who's rarely lost a case, if ever. We'll see what happens. Republicans have seen before their rhetoric can go a little bit over the top sometimes when it comes to Benghazi. But just with like the foundation stories with Benghazi, you get a sense from the Clinton camp when you talk to them privately that they have a Teflon sensibility, that this stuff is going to bounce off of Clinton and that eventually, because she doesn't have much of a primary and Republicans' own internal problems, she'll survive all of it.
Let me get some callers in. Let's see what Bob from South Jersey has to say. Bob, go ahead. You're on radio. Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Marty.
Sure.
At this time of the election season, it's obviously not only my opinion, but it seems that the fringe right and the fringe left kind of dictate the debate. I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I am fiscally conservative and socially liberal or moderate. Do your callers think that Democrats can impact the Republican primary because Jeb Bush is literally that, a fiscal conservative, but maybe a lot more socially moderate than the other candidates? And if Democrats started supporting him, and I know that sounds crazy in a primary, you know, they can switch parties, would that impact the race at all? And I'll listen offline.
Sure. Thanks for calling in to Radio Times. Sam, but just picking up on what Bob said at the very beginning, describing, I guess, some of the candidates we've been talking about as fringe left and fringe right. Does the political system that we have today, does it encourage these fringe candidates?
I think that's actually an antiquated way to look at what's happening right now in our country. I think you got to drop this notion of a right and a left here, because there are several issues that have and continue to be exhibiting amazing crossover ideological appeal. So let's take a few of them. For instance, criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. We have people from Rick Perry to Rand Paul to Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama, all basically on the same philosophical page when it comes to the need to reduce, have sentencing reforms, equal punishment or more equal punishment for crimes involving drugs, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of those issues. On the issue of inequality, I was at a firefighters union political event a couple months back, and Ted Cruz got up there and he started talking about there being two Americas. Now, that's rhetoric that you associate with, Mario Cuomo and John Edwards, not with Ted Cruz. But essentially, everyone recognizes that something has to be done to reduce rampant inequality in this country. Foreign policy is a slightly worse example. But, for better or worse, Rand Paul has moved his party a little bit in the way against the neoconservative wing, more open-minded about the perils of getting involved in nation building overextension. And that is aligned with, a lot of liberal foreign policy thinking. Same thing with privacy and data collection. So there are a whole host of issues in which the traditional right-left continuum doesn't really apply anymore.
Robert, do you agree?
I do. And I have an article up with David Nakamura, my colleague at The Washington Post today, about how Clinton on immigration specifically is really pushing the Republican Party. She came out with the comments in Las Vegas on Tuesday to say she embraced the president's move to protect illegal immigrants from deportation. And she said she'd continue that policy, in fact, expand it. And I think a lot of Republicans yesterday were muted in their response. They recognized that the country is trending in a different direction on immigration. And the kind of response you would have expected, a forceful, almost angry take, really wasn't out there. Even Ted Cruz just issued a statement on Facebook. Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio didn't do anything at all, just pointed to past statements. I think that's indicative that Clinton's seizing the moment and trying to get the Republican Party in a tough corner on one of their trickiest issues.
Well, and even more broadly speaking, back to you, Robert, and then we'll get back to our callers. It's been sort of the way things are done in the past is that if you're a Republican in the primary, you tack right. If you're a Democrat, you tack left, and then you come back in the middle. Are you saying that those days may be over?
They are.
Me? Especially Robert.
I'll put that to you, Robert, but Sam, I'd like to have you weigh in as
sure.
Well. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, I think that the tradition has always been to move right in a Republican primary and try to win Iowa, get a bounce. But because the field is so big, I think that dynamic perhaps has changed. You don't see Jeb Bush running to the right. You see him trying to run almost a general election campaign in the primary. Scott Walker was pretty aggressive in his statement against Clinton's immigration move. At the same time, a lot of candidates recognize Republicans have not won the past two presidential elections. They've really struggled to adjust to the demographic change in the country. And as much as they want to win the nomination, even if you get that nomination, for it to be worth something, you have to have a shot in the general election. And to do so, you have to come up with a message that's compelling to Hispanic voters, to swing voters, those who are skeptical of the GOP.
Sam, go ahead.
I mean, I agree with that. I mean, obviously, it still applies that you have to appeal predominantly to your base during a primary election. And I imagine that all these candidates are going to produce policy platforms that, you know, pretty much toe the conservative line on the major issues of the day, whether it's immigration, tax policy, foreign policy, et cetera. But because of the huge primary field that Robert just referenced, you will have the opportunity for people like Jeb to say, you know, I'm not going to play the game. I'm not going to sign Grover Norquist's tax pledge. I'm going to propose spending money on NIH research. You do have people like Mike Huckabee saying, you know, we should really protect entitlements, not reform entitlements. So there will be that crossover candidate. I just think that the issues are so much more complex in this day and age that you have to look at them holistically. And so, yeah, on tax policy, for instance, every Republican is going to say, yeah, reduce the tax rates, reduce regulation, so on and so forth. But on a whole host of other matters, we're talking about very complex, delicate issues where there isn't that sort of vast ideological separation that you would have imagined in elections past.
Let me get Dave from Maple Glen to join our conversation. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Hi there.
Good show.
Thank you.
I appreciate a lot of this, but I get discouraged because, when we talk about fringe candidates and leading candidates, we're 10 months or 8-9 months away from the first primary, and we're labeling people fringe candidates. And I would point to Bernie Sanders, for example, who most of his positions, in fact, I would say all of his positions, the polls show are majoritarian positions in the United States. And the only reason that a guy like Bernie, who has vast Senate experience and administrative experience, you know, as a mayor in Burlington, is considered a fringe candidate is because the media won't talk about his issues. They talk about his motives. Is he running to push Hillary to the left, or is he seriously running? He has to be in the Democratic primary in order for to even have his issues mentioned. And that's the media's fault.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Dave, we wanted to include Bernie Sanders because I do think he has a lot to say. And yes, we've been talking about the sort of political dynamics, but I think content-wise, Sam Stein, Bernie Sanders brings a lot to the table.
Yeah, I disagree with Dave. I mean, we were talking about the issues that he brings to the table just 10 minutes ago. Campaign finance reform, the need to break up the banks, massive investment in infrastructure, the idea that you can have single-payer health care. Those are all issues that he wants to debate, and by jumping into this election, he will see them debated. Now, does that change the fact that he has very long odds to be elected president? No, but I don't think we should hide that fact. I mean, he's actually, by running, sort of exhibiting the exact issues that he wants to show, which is that a lot of this election is determined by a very small group of high money donors. And he's going against that very small group of deep-pocketed donors himself. So, I don't think we're doing Bernie a disservice by acknowledging that he's got a big road to hoe. It's just, we also should talk about the issues, and I think we're doing that as well.
Thanks for the call, Dave. To you, Robert, and talking about money, there was a piece recently about Hillary Clinton. I mean, she's going for the big cash.
She is, and she's signaled that she's actually going to help raise money for her super PAC, Priorities USA, and she's been having meetings in the past week or so with most of her major donors, because I think she's watching Jeb Bush across the way, and she sees that you're going to need $100 million, $200 million, maybe even $1 billion to run a primary campaign and then even double that in a general election campaign. And so Sanders may be running a grassroots small-dollar operation, but it's the big money that seems to be the key to having a campaign that's successful and can go the full way.
Are we talking billions here, Robert?
We're talking billions. I mean, the last election was billion-dollar election for both sides. And I think it's every campaign I talk to, they think if they win the nomination, they're going to probably have to spend anywhere between $200 to $500 million to win a primary and $1 billion in a general.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, talk about an arms race, right, Sam?
it's crazy.
It's crazy.
It's a lot of money. And, if you're a TV station manager in Iowa or New Hampshire, you must be smiling because that money is going into your station and not anyone else's.
Final question. I'll put this to you, Robert, only because you had a piece about this, asking Republicans whether they would go to a gay wedding or not. This was a couple of weeks ago. But it was interesting to see a number of the candidates kind of turn themselves into a bit of a pretzel in trying to give a response.
Republicans are looking at this upcoming Supreme Court decision, and they're grappling with how to respond because they know the poll numbers for gay marriage are very much in support, 60% according to our latest poll. And so how to adjust to the culture war when you're losing it is a difficult proposition. And so I think Republicans are trying to say, look, we're not anti-gay. We'd attend a gay wedding. We may still support what they call traditional marriage. But they also see the writing on the wall. And I'm not so sure that we saw in campaigns past they wanted to fight on the social issues. Maybe not so much anymore.
How about for you, Sam?
I think they would love nothing more than the Supreme Court to rule that marriage is a constitutional right and solve the issue from there on out. Sure, there's going to be a Republican or two in the race who pivots off that and makes a big stink about it and calls for a constitutional amendment and so on and so forth. But I think they want this thing as far away from the front burner as possible. And you already can tell with their rhetoric, whereas, two cycles ago, the talk was about a federal marriage amendment to sanctify the marriage was between a man and a woman. Now, virtually all of them are talking about the need to respect state sovereignty on this issue and let the states decide, which is at odds with the federal marriage amendment. So it seems pretty clear to me and to them, and too, that they are on the wrong side of the arc of history on this one.
Well, my thanks to both of you. Sam Stein, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's political editor, White House correspondent for the Huffington Post. Robert Costa, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. National political reporter for the Washington Post. And again, this is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, Thursdays, where we devote the hour to all things political and election related. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, and how to listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.